Hello for everybody that is listening this radio station, Free Radio Santa Cruz, in 101.1 FM. Our direction in the net is www.freakradio.org. I repeat, www.freakradio.org. This is Subcomandante Insurgente Marcos from National Liberation Zapatist Army from Mexico, from Chiapas, Mexico. We are fighting for the freedom, for the democracy, and for the liberty of all our people, all Mexico.
Next on Free Radio, which is what you're tuned to, 101.1 FM, also www.freakradio.org. It's Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides with me, Robert Norris. I'm your host. Be with you for 2 hours. Stay tuned.
First they arrest you and throw you in jail. Tap all your phones and then jack up your bail, 'cause they're so in love, they can't get you out of their mind. They're watching your house and they follow your car. They're tracking your movements wherever you are, 'cause they're so in love, they can't get you out of their mind. And you have to make court dates a whole lot of times. It's because they're in love. What else could it possibly be? It happens because they're in love with you, the way they're all in love with me.
And that was Carol Denny from her album, You Are Spending Too Much Money on Your Hair. It's not police surveillance, it's love. Let's hear another quickie from, actually, a little longer one this time, from Carol, and then on with the show.
There's a rusty old truck riding hard through the country, hard down a rough road. Legal business and nobody wrong. Truck has no headlights. Sometimes I think I can see it all clearly. Sometimes I think it gets harder to call. The rain and the sun have no interest in us, and political winds can change fastest of all. Calling it wheels is the kind side of flying, but I know it's nature and so far it's might. Maybe we have a few things here in common. There's a lot this truck simply likes leaving.
Those were two cuts from Carol Denny. Again, it's not police surveillance, it's love, and Birthday Truck Song. Boy, I'm going to be playing some interesting stuff, at least stuff I found interesting, on safe injection centers in North America, which there is one, as far as I know, legal such place in Vancouver. It was highlighted on Democracy Now! About a week ago. And I'm tempted to even replay that segment, but since Democracy Now! Is easily downloadable, and most folks who listen to this show, or some who do anyway, do listen to Democracy Now!, and it's on this station as well at 8 o'clock, and I believe at noon, twice every weekday, that might not be necessary. Plus, you can upload it, or download it, I should say, from the website, democracynow.org. But I actually went directly to the Vancouver Safe Injection site in order to get a kind of more information. And I found some interesting stuff. Let's see if my mic is up. There we go. Mic up and speaker down. And what did I find? Well, assuming I can get this computer to work a bit, which is sometimes a challenge. I found an interesting chronology. I'm going to read some of this chronology to you, and then I'm going to play you some of the actual synopsis and interviews from the Vancouver site itself. It's actually part of a video, but you'll be able to hear the audio part of it. And I imagine the visual part of it is actually even more shocking, because you'll see some pretty stern stuff. But the reason I get into this, since my topic is usually homeless civil rights, is the drug war is a key part of the attack on homeless people, and in fact on everybody in the society. The notion that you must give the police the power, and the prisons the power, and the politicians the power, and probation the power, and the pharmaceutical companies, and the courts, all these powers to supposedly deal with a medical problem. And it's an absurdity, and it's a real vicious absurdity that results in our having, I think it's the highest incarceration rate, if not in the world, at least the second or third highest rate, it might be the highest, and rising at a huge rate. And even in Santa Cruz, as Anita Henry, our medical marijuana distributor person who came into the studio along with Craig Canada a few shows ago, said, she's also the Measure K commissioner, one of the commissioners that is appointed to supposedly oversee the police and make sure that they make marijuana enforcement the lowest priority, but they have no power to do so because the Rapkin City Council has essentially helped to remove that power. We have the drug war impacting a lot of poor people. It becomes the basis for arresting them, citing them, jailing them, giving them stay-away orders. searching them, seizing their property, and so forth. And it's, of course, it's cruel, it's absurd, it's costly. It's something that Americans generally agreed, at least it was common wisdom, that alcohol prohibition never worked. Similarly, marijuana prohibition and prohibition of other hard drugs doesn't work in terms of stopping the use. Although, no doubt, you'll have people claiming, and this is a debate that should go on, that imposing legal sanctions cuts down on the use, that if you didn't, you'd have a much higher usage. Indeed, there are some statistics, I believe, and this is what we call the reluctant admission, because I think it may be true, reluctant testimony, that I've read in different places that there were some benefits to alcohol prohibition in the 20s in terms of a lowered rate of sclerosis of the liver, and there may have been a drop in some parts of the population using alcohol. Again, I'm not too sure of that second. But, of course, there were also many other costs that ultimately resulted in people deciding, or who knows, maybe the liquor industry got together. I don't know the exact background and reasons for the ending of alcohol prohibition. I like to make sure I'm not simply mouthing the pieties that we all think are true, but that we haven't really researched. And I haven't done a lot of research. I've read a little bit about it. But it is my conviction, and I guess I would say my belief, that the drug war, the drug prohibition, is as pointless as I and many other Americans and, who knows, I mean, other people worldwide believe the alcohol prohibition to have been absurd. Anyway, here's this chronology from the website. If I can actually get this computer in an operational mode here. I believe it's a Vancouver safe injection site for intravenous drug addicts, and it's called, I think it's called Portland House. Do I have that right? Well, let me read you what the chronology has to say. Over the last several decades, this is how the chronology begins, the drug scene in Vancouver develops in the city's downtown east side. The area has become notorious for its drug scene, where just about anything can be bought for $10. There are about 5,000 injection drug users in the downtown east side, and many live in an eight-block area. 1994, following a call for supervised injection sites by the chief coroner of British Columbia, that's the province in which Vancouver is situated up north, it's the westernmost province of Canada, a group of individuals opened a site called the Back Alley site. The police closed the site down after 1 year. Interesting, it was 1 year that was open. I don't know, I haven't done much research, but I guess that might have had something to do with the chief coroner of the British Columbia actually supporting supervised injection sites. January 1995, British Columbia Chief Coroner Vince Kane issues a major report on drug overdose deaths and recommends that addiction be treated as a health issue instead of a criminal one. He even advocates giving out free heroin. July 1997, downtown Eastside organizers put up 1,200 crosses in Oppenheimer Park to mark deaths from drug overdoses, the beginning of a street-level campaign for sanctioned injection sites. July 1998, a report by British Columbia Public Health Officer James Miller says the province has an epidemic of death and disease caused by drugs as overdose deaths spike and HIV and hepatitis C infection rates reach third world levels. 2001. By 2001, Vancouver formally adopts harm reduction as a centerpiece of its drug policy. The four pillars approach focuses on prevention, treatment, enforcement, and harm reduction. The position is consistent with Canada's national drug strategy, which states that substance abuse is primarily a health issue rather than an enforcement issue. Harm reduction is considered to be a realistic and humane approach. Notice throughout this entire time, there has been no opening of a safe injection site other than the one that was opened by independently and illegally and then was closed by police after a year. So you can see how the rhetoric and the good intentions outstrip the reality, although the reality gets put into place by dedicated people willing to break the law. Sort of like free radio, maybe. November 2002, former coroner Larry Campbell is elected mayor
on a promise to clean up. And hang on just a second here. On a promise to buy me a new computer. No, to clean up the downtown east side and get an injection site opened by the end of the year. He heads to Ottawa, which is the capital of Canada, in December to talk to the federal government. September 2003, this is a year later, Health Canada grants Vancouver Coastal Health a 3 years exemption under Section 56 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act to establish North America's first supervised injection site, scientific research project at 139 Hastings Street in Vancouver. Researchers from the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS acts as evaluators of InSight, as it's called, I-N-S-I-T-E, that's the name of this site, InSight. They have been monitoring the site and publishing their findings in peer-reviewed journals. Health Canada provided about $1.5 million, I guess Health Canada is a national health service in Canada, perhaps, to fund only this evaluative component of the project. The government of the British Columbia has been responsible for funding the administration and all other aspects associated with the operation of the site. So the federal government in Canada, somewhat like the U.S. federal government, was willing to support to fund an evaluation of it and to allow an exemption from the bust them if they've got hard drugs or are using hard drugs or are giving away hard drugs. And the province head, sort of like our state government, were willing to actually fund the administration of that place. They actually fund the purchase of the drugs, fund the clean facilities, the clean shooting facilities. The exemption and evaluation funding were to conclude on September 12, 2006. The Drug Prevention Network of Canada, DPNC, is formed by former Reform MP Randy White. The DPNC opposes harm reduction and the supervised injection site. January 24, 2006, the Harper government comes to power. That's a government, a national government in Canada. June 2006, Prime Minister Harper tells Vancouver reporters that he is waiting for assessments from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, kind of like the FBI or National Police in Canada, and other agencies before making a decision on what to do about InSight. Sounds like the drug warriors at this point are winning. June 7, 2006, the drug prohibition warriors, I should say. The researchers who are studying InSight from the Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS publish a study in the New England Journal of Medicine which says the more a drug user visits Vancouver's supervised injection site, the more likely that user is to go into detox. September 1, 2006, the BC British Columbia Division of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the Canadian Police Association make statements against keeping InSight open, somewhat similar to police statements in the United States against legalizing marijuana or having medical marijuana. It seems to be a national police position or international police position on this, and it's, I think, the wrong one. September 1st, 2006, then-Health Minister Tony Clement advises Vancouver Coastal Health that their exemption, I guess that was the name of the group that was running InSight, Vancouver Coastal Health, that their exemption will be extended to December 31st, 2007 to allow for more research on how supervised injection sites affect prevention, treatment, and crime, but the government will no longer provide funding for the evaluation component. They're trying to starve it out. Fall 2006, according to the Pivot Legal Society, the RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, approaches Colin Mangum, Director of Research for the Drug Prevention Network of Canada, to write a critique on the pre-existing research on InSight. November 21, 2006, researchers Evan Woods, Mark Tyndall, Julio Montaner, and Theodore Kerr of the Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS publish their summary of findings in the Canadian Medical Association Journal from the evaluation of InSight. The researchers conclude that the facility does not encourage drug use. Drug addicts who use the site are being referred to treatment, and they are less likely to share needles and to overdose. December 2006, Expert Advisory Committee on Supervised Injection Site is established. The EAC, Expert Advisory Committee, will provide Tony Clement with scientific advice on the analysis of the supervised injection site. January 3, 2007, Health Minister Tony Clement pays an unexpected visit to InSite, but leaves without indicating if it will be permitted to operate beyond the end of the year. January 17, 2 weeks later, DPNC's Director of Research, that's the anti-drug or the drug prohibition people, Colin Mangum's critique of InSite is published, commissioned by the RCMP. It's completed. September 2007, St. Michael's Hospital researcher Stephen Huang writes a commentary in the online journal Open Medicine accusing the feds of allowing ideology to trump science. Sound familiar? The commentary is signed by more than 130 physicians and scientists, and the article is in this. It's also published. I'll give you the website when this is over. Mid-September 2007, InSite sets up a detox floor with 12 beds on the second floor of its building. It's called OnSite. October 1, 2007, BC Premier, British Columbia Premier Gordon Campbell expresses public support for the injection site. Imagine somebody like Schwarzenegger actually having the courage to do that here, or some Democratic Party hack like Gray Davis, or it's like Tom Amiano not just saying that marijuana should be legalized, but that there should be places where people can inject hard drugs, take it off the streets for harm reduction. You think that's going to happen in our generation in the United States? Interesting question. Continuing with this analysis of the one injection site, safe and legal injection site on the North American continent. March 31st, 2008. The Expert Advisory Committee completes its report on InSite research prepared for Tony Clement. April 2008, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users and the Portland Hotel Society mount a constitutional challenge of the federal government's power to close the facility, arguing that the site addresses a public health crisis. May 27, 2008, Justice Ian Pitfield of the British Columbia Supreme Court rules that the federal government does not have the authority to close InSite. Pitfield grants InSite an immediate exemption and gives the federal government until June 30, 2009 to amend the country's drug laws to allow for the medical use of drugs if tied to a health care initiative. August 2008, Tony Clement slams InSite at the 2008 International Conference on AIDS in New York City. He calls InSite an abomination. October 8, 2008. Pivot Legal Society writes to the Auditor General asking for an investigation into the Royal Canadian Mounted Police's actions regarding InSite. April 27, 2009. Date set for the British Columbia Court of Appeals to hear the federal government's appeal of Justice Pitfield's ruling. The British Columbia Court of Appeal has set aside 3 days to hear the appeal. The British Columbia government is already an intervener and is expected that the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association will apply to intervene in support of InSite. And I think that's as far as this chronology went, kind of leaving us hanging here. And I've actually just kind of begun my research on this. So you're getting some of the raw material on this show, but to me it's very provocative that not only has a safe injection site been established, but it's been established over the objections of the current conservative government, the police departments up there, and the courts are siding with InSite, with the harm reduction program, saying that it's constitutionally required that the government allow these sites to set up, if not to fund them, with under the National Health Program up in Canada. Let's take a brief break, or actually let me just get this phone call and then we'll see what happens next, but maybe time to take a break. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert.
Greetings.
I got a couple of comments relative to drugs, hard use, or hard drugs, or marijuana, too. I had a friend in high school, we smoked some pot and things like that. He happened to go in a direction of harder-type drugs and cocaine, heroin, things like that. I believe the thing that really messed his life up, was being thrown in prison for use of drugs. And I've seen him for 50 years now, and his life is destroyed. But I believe the destruction of his life came about from primarily from the use of his, primarily from being having so many jail terms. I mean, he was in San Quentin and, you know, some really heavy places. And that changed him completely. I believe that if he would have had the use of drugs, his life it would have been physically compromised. But the jail time just destroyed him. It really did.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one comment. On some of the studies that they do, this was in the 90s. I heard about this study, and it was from the people who wanted to keep marijuana illegal. They said they wanted to do a study that would see whether or not marijuana was addictive. So what they did is they got funding for it. They had controlled lab. They put a monkey in a situation where he had an intravenous feed on each of his arms. One of those feed, and they had a button to trigger the intravenous feed to start. One of the intravenous feeders had water. One had water with THC. He continually pressed the one with THC, and from that they deduced that marijuana was addictive.
Hmm.
Interesting.
You know, I guess my question has always been locally. I mean, you have, of course, this backward riptide against marijuana, which it's really kind of silly to even talk about marijuana for me. I mean, it's an issue that's been decided. The problem is that you have a bunch of liberal politicians who listen to the police and conservative hysterics on this issue.
Yes,
and,
you do.
And masquerade as liberals on the city council, and people let them get away with it because they're preoccupied with other matters like making a living, and they like to believe that, gee, if Valerie Corral's Wham is allowed to help 200 people, then everything is rosy, when in fact it was Corral's failure to speak up on these issues for 5 years that kept all distribution centers closed between 2000 and 2005 in Santa Cruz, although to her credit, she has recently spoken up, I believe, about the latest unanimous vote to extend the ban on new medical marijuana distribution centers passed by the city council last Tuesday.
Do you know what the justification is to having, was it two distribution centers?
The justification is that the you have two different kind of streams of thought that are coinciding here. One is, I think, a more legitimate than the other, is the belief that marijuana should not be profiteered off of, that it should not be a basis for making a lot of money, and therefore you want to make sure that these newcomers don't make a lot of money off marijuana. That's point number one, which, you know, I have a sympathy for that, but then why don't you go after pharmacies, alcohol distribution centers, all kinds of, you know, used car dealers, I don't know, whoever's making a huge amount of profit. I'm
Robert,
not sure.
Isn't that anti-American?
Right. I mean, you know, there are those who believe in the free enterprise. This is based, these are people who feel that, you know, marijuana should be grown collectively and cooperatively, and it should be legal. A lot of us agree with that. And they don't want to see, you know, big business take it over. That's actually, some people have spoken against the legalization of marijuana initiative by, you know, pointing out that it's being backed by some of the big medical marijuana distributors up in Oakland, one in particular. And I'm not saying, you know, I mean, that's a concern and that's a consideration. But the other and the far more, I think, toxic claims are, and I think false claims or misleading claims, are that Santa Cruz is going to become a mecca for people who want to buy medical marijuana, as though that's a bad thing, because it's one of the few places where medical marijuana is sold, let's say, between here and San Francisco or here and Santa Barbara. Actually, that's no longer true. More centers are opening up in San Jose.
Well, let's get more.
But, you know, there's some dubious statistics, which may or may not be true, that only a quarter of the marijuana sold is sold to people who are within the city limits, and only 50% within the county limits. But no such studies are done for anything else that's sold, and singling out marijuana when it's actually it's safer than banks. I mean, banks get robbed. There have been no calls for service to the police at these two centers that I know of. At least they claim there have been no calls for service or no complaints. Maybe that's the word. In the last 4 years since they've been open and 5 years since Greenway has been open. So, I mean, the claim is that the planning department got all these concerns about, we got all these calls. The federal government is no longer going to arrest people for medical marijuana, which isn't true. They still are doing that. But, you know, there was some usual Obama foggy rhetoric about this. And so the planning department got two applications for medical marijuana centers, and they moved to shut them down by having the Santa Cruz City Council pass an emergency measure last June and extending it in July, now extending it again last week, banning the opening of medical marijuana centers, or putting a moratorium on it. This is something used throughout the state by different cities. It's reefer madness under another name, in my view. So.
Oh, Robert, my phone's going to die, and I just have one last comment.
Please, I'm sorry, I went on there.
That's okay. I want to have the bumper sticker made up. Government, please stop trying to protect me from myself.
Right. Well, I mean, I suppose we may not agree on what the government should protect us from, but if you're putting people in jail under the guise of protecting them, I don't think that's a safe environment to protect them in, as you pointed out.
Or keeping the drugs that are not harmful illegal.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Robert.
Thank you for calling in. Bye-bye. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. I just did a quick look at the Wikipedia site on safe injection sites. So there's a couple of interesting points here. Guidelines for the operation and the use of consumption rooms define injecting rooms as legally sanctioned and supervised facilities designed to reduce the health and public order problems associated with illegal drug use. It describes various facilities where the consumption of illicit substances is legally permitted. The main focus for these facilities is reducing the harm associated with injecting drug use. There are very few in existence, mostly in Europe, with one in Australia and another in Canada. The European rooms operate as drug consumption rooms, which means that they are simply spaces where consumption of illicit substances is legal. The Australian and Canadian facilities were set up later and operate as supervised injecting facility in Canada and medically supervised injecting center in Australia. In these facilities, illicit drug use is permitted, but there is a more clinical approach to the service delivery with a large staff of nurses overseeing proceedings, and basic life support equipment is available if needed. There are none in the United States. As of 2000, and this is, of course, somewhat outdated, there were 16 legal drug consumption rooms in the Netherlands, the first being set up in the 1970s, 17 in Switzerland, the first in 1985, and 13 in Germany, the first in 1994. In Oslo, Norway, opened in 2005, and Copenhagen, Denmark, 2007. These centers are usually located in urban areas with the primary aims to replace negative health effects and minimize the public disturbance arising from street-based drug use. The Sydney Medically Supervised Injecting Center opened in May 2001 in King's Cross, Sydney. It was set up as a recommendation of the Wood Royal Commission to combat street crime in the area and reduce police corruption. The Canadian Insight commenced operation in 2003, as well as public order and improving health. The major difference between the supervising injecting centers and the unsupervised European model is the more clinical nature of the service. Oxygen and Narcan, I'm not sure if I have that pronounced right, are administered in the case of opioid and heroin overdose. Opposition. Injecting rooms are controversial because they are an attempt to decrease the negative consequences of existing drug use rather than punish drug users through law enforcement. Critics of the practice say that they encourage drug abuse. A common approach to drug policy is to have three layers: harm prevention, to prevent people first using drugs; supply reduction, to prevent drugs from reaching the population; harm reduction, to prevent harm to people who use drugs despite the attempts of the previous two policy focuses. Injecting centers fall under this approach. I don't mention the fourth leg, which is apparently part of the Canadian policy, which is enforcement, which means arresting people who use or have paraphernalia or who sell or who buy. Much of the controversy over injecting centers is about the distribution of resources between the three approaches. For example, the conservative Australian politician Gordon Moyes and Fred Nile, politicians, say that little or no money should be spent on harm minimization strategies and instead redirect funds to preventative measures. Opponents argue that the sites send a message that the government supports illegal drug use and that the sites themselves are unnecessary, costly, and contribute to crime in the areas in which they are situated. Many of the assessments carried out in the Canadian and Australian projects have found no evidence to back this last crime, that there's crime in the areas. So, I think I have an actual, well, let me play, if I can find the darn thing. There's actually a bit of the audio of an interesting video on the subject, which I saw earlier, assuming I can actually get it to download. Which would be nice. It seems to be taking its time. Maybe it will. And maybe it won't. Let me try another site. Maybe I can get this to download. We may be getting somewhere here. But again, taking an awfully long time, and I'm not sure why. I think we are getting close. Still looking. Sorry about this, folks. I thought I had this pretty much together, and I actually think I do here. But this computer is very slow and wants to take its time, your time, and my time. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, and www.freakradio.org. Let's listen to a tour of the InSight facility up in Vancouver, why it was established, and what services it provides to people at risk in Vancouver's downtown east side. This is actually a video, but I'm playing the audio portion. I'm trying to play the audio portion. And I think it's starting here. It's supposed to be starting. It's still transferring data. Should be starting momentarily. The reason this is an important issue for me is, of course, because so often homeless people are on the front lines of this drug war. Here we go.
Users in Vancouver live in the downtown east side, and they're certainly the city's most visible. Because they're poor and marginalized, many end up injecting their drugs in the streets and back alleys in very unsanitary conditions.
Typically, someone like myself would score their dope and then come in this alley here to consume it, and usually go in a doorway like this, and as you can see, the sidewalk here is covered with human excrement. What happens when I run out of dope is I look for more on the ground. Well, right now she's tweaking out. She's looking for dope that someone might have dropped.
They're, you know, fixing their drugs and using them in a way that's really unhygienic and contaminating
half
the
of all injection
that they
drug
do get
users
that are
in
clean.
Vancouver live in an extremely dangerous
side.
Practice,
and
there's certainly
pick up
the city's most visible
that have been discarded
because they're poor and
good
marginalized.
It was used
many
by,
end up injecting
somebody
their drugs
with a
in
blood-borne illness,
back alleys,
HIV, AIDS,
in very unsanitary.
Hepatitis C.
They use contaminated water from puddles.
So this is very dangerous.
In fact, a third of injection drug users in Vancouver are HIV positive. 90% or more have contracted hepatitis C from sharing needles.
They end up with lots of abscesses, which for a healthy person, it may clear up right away, but for them, it turns into a big ulcer, either on their arm or their leg, could be in their neck, could be anywhere they're injecting. The other thing is that can go on to develop septicemia or blood poisoning, and they can, you know, end up in the hospital with septic shock.
Well, without access to clean needles, people have been converting to HIV at a very rapid rate. So what we've seen in the last 8 years is a tremendous number of people dying of AIDS. In addition to that, there's a horrendous overdose rate.
being in the alley, you know, they're always looking over their shoulder. They're not sure who's around, how safe it is. They rush and they do things that they wouldn't normally do. And as a result of that, you know, they misjudge how much they inject and they can overdose. And if they're by themselves, most likely they'll die at that site.
In the past 5 years, 524 people have died of drug overdose in Vancouver. 309 have died of AIDS.
The reason people should care is people are dying. If people were dying in other parts of the city and other parts of the province in great numbers as they are concentrated in the downtown east side, we would do something.
As well as the human cost, there's a huge financial burden on the healthcare system.
The cost of intravenous drug users continues to go up. The cost of getting an HIV infection, huge.
Many people have open wounds that are open for a year, year and a half. That results in skin grafting, so they have to go up to plastic surgery. It's specialist. Even then, it doesn't heal properly, and then they need amputations. So when you add it all up, it's a huge cost to our system.
In an effort to reduce the health risk and ease the pressure on hospital emergency rooms, Vancouver Coastal Health has built a supervised injection site at 139 East Hastings, a first for North America.
The number of overdose deaths clearly go down. The number of people getting HIV infections clearly go down in the group that use these sites.
Hopefully, we'll reach a population that we don't normally reach, that don't come to the clinics for help unless they're in dire straits or don't go to the emergency department. And once they come into the supervised injection site and they see that it's okay, they can come in, they can use safely, people are there to help them, support them, is that we can go about educating them.
The supervised injection site is a clean, safe environment where users can inject their own drugs under the supervision of clinical staff who can also provide first aid and wound care. Nurses and counselors can provide on-site access and referral to addictions treatment, primary health care, and mental health services. An important component is a scientific research project. Its goal is to assess whether the supervised injection site will reduce the harm associated with illicit drug use.
We'll be able to evaluate who is using the site, why they're using the site, why they're coming here, and the impact on the community overall.
The supervised injection site is only one part of a broader plan to address addiction issues in the downtown east side.
Everybody's involved in this. Our partners include the city, the police, health partners, the IV drug using community, the community at large, and not-for-profit organizations like the Portland Hotel Society.
This is how the supervised injection site works. For safety reasons, cameras inside and outside the site are monitored at reception and in the injection room. Clients coming to the door are buzzed in by a staff member at reception.
Just the regular?
They're led through a waiting area to a secure door into a 12-seat injection room where they first wash their hands. Then they're given a disposable injection kit that includes clean needles, cookers, tourniquets, and clean water. In a mirrored stall, under the supervision of trained medical staff, they inject their own drugs.
Each cubicle has a mirror, and the mirrors are both for the users and for the staff. The user's safety so that they can see if anyone is behind them, but as well for the nursing staff so that they can more adequately see the users as they're injecting and make some interventions if need be if somebody requires some help or assistance.
After injecting, they go to a post-injection chill-out room before being discharged to the street. If they have wounds, abscesses, or other infections, they can receive treatment in the primary health care room. In the chill-out room, they can also get addiction and peer counseling and referral to treatment services. Why is it important to do this?
A supervised injection site will save a lot of lives. And there's a lot of people who don't live long enough to ever make it into any kind of detox program or recovery program.
How will it help injection drug users?
It's essential that we have places that are safer for people to consume drugs.
Will they use the site?
If it's a welcoming place that they trust the staff, they know when they come in they're not going to be judged, they're going to be treated with respect.
These are not stupid people. They care about their health. They have an addiction, but they really do care about their health. They use the needle exchange program. They use the other services that we have down there. So they will use this.
The site will be open 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, so that we'll be here when the users want to access the site and when they need us.
How will it benefit the community at large?
Benefit for the community is they don't have these people in the alleyways, in the crawl spaces, all over the place, shooting up drugs. They're in a safe, warm place. They're off the street. The community benefits both ways.
For the taxpayers, the positive benefit is that all the medical costs that go with injecting in a really unhygienic manner can go away because it's all preventable.
Give it a chance. See what happens. Don't judge it before it's operational, and I think you're going to find out that this is a good idea.
And that was a audio of a video. You can go online to supervisedinjection.vch.ca-home or just Google for injection sites, and you'll find this under Vancouver Health, I believe. This is one of a number of videos on this Vancouver Coastal Health Supervised Injection Site website. There's some others as well. Folks may recognize this, the audio of this particular show, which again happened, February 3rd. This is Democracy Now! In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Dr. Gaber Maté, physician at Vancouver Site Injections, Safe Injection Site on the Biological and Socioeconomic Roots of Addiction and ADD. And again, I'm not going to play much of this. I'm going to play a little of it, and then we're going to move on to more standard topics or possibly your phone calls, 427-3772, area code 831-427-3772. What about why aren't there injection sites in your city? Is there a hard drug problem? Is it best left to cops and perhaps courts and mandatory, AA programs and alcohol and other similar Narcotics Anonymous programs? Are these working in terms of either helping the society or helping the individuals involved? Are they fair? Are they sensible? I, of course, have some what you might consider predictable answers if you've heard my show before. But the real question is, what are your answers and what do you want to say about this to a city, county, state that is doing exactly the opposite in terms of harm reduction on these issues, that is increasing the budgets for drug warriors and increasing the number of arrests, increasing the essentially violence against drug users, increasing the crackdown under the delusion that this somehow will create a drug-free society. At the same time, of course, supporting massive use of so-called legal drugs that are often much more toxic and debilitating than those sold on the streets in terms of their total effect on society. And I'm not even talking about alcohol and tobacco. I'm talking about pharmaceuticals that are supposedly medically prescribed. Anyway, here's a little of that and perhaps some of your calls. Who knows? It's taking a little while to boot up. Here we are, Democracy Now!
Jay Flash here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Obama administration's budget proposal for the Office of National Drug Control Policy sets aside nearly twice the amount of funding for law enforcement and criminalization than for treatment and prevention of drug addiction. Out of a total of $15.5 billion, some $10 billion are used for enforcement. National Drug Control Policy Gil Kerkowski praised the numbers as reflecting a balanced and comprehensive drug strategy. Well, just last year, the newly appointed drug czar and former Seattle police chief had called for an end to the so-called war on drugs, raising hopes among advocates of harm reduction approaches to curbing drug use. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal last May, Kerlikowski said people see a war as a war on them. We're not at war with people in this country. Well, I'm joined right now here in the Democracy Now! Studio by a doctor who spent the last 12 years working with one of the densest populations of drug addicts in the world. Dr. Gabor Mate is the staff physician at the Portland Hotel, a residence and harm reduction facility in Vancouver, Canada's downtown east side. Dr. Mate also treats addicts at the only safe injection site in North America, a center that's come under fire from Canada's Conservative government led by Stephen Harper. Dr. Gabor Mate is the best-selling author of four books. His latest, just out in the United States, is called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. Welcome to Democracy Now!,
Pleasure
Dr. Mate.
Good.
Now, what do you mean the only safe injection site, the only legal injection site in North America? People inject heroin there?
People are allowed to bring their drugs there. We don't provide them with their drugs. I think we should, but we don't. But they bring it in, and without fear of being arrested, they're allowed to inject under supervision, and the staff, without being fear of arrested, are allowed to help them inject in a safe way, give them clean needles, sterile swabs, and resuscitate them if they overdose. So everywhere else in Canada or in states, of course, these activities would all be illegal.
Why are they allowed to do this?
Well, it was conceived at a moment of political openness because so many people pass on infections like HIV and hepatitis C to one another through injection use, sharing needles. They infect themselves with bacteria from their skin by using dirty water. So it's a harm reduction measure that in many studies have been shown to reduce the burden of disease and also the economic costs attendant to addiction to society.
And do you find that addicts can actually heal themselves or perhaps be able to get off heroin more easily by injecting there?
Well, the facility is not designed to treat addiction per se. It's designed to reduce the harm from it. It's a harm reduction measure. What we do find, though, is that we have a detox facility on the second floor, which is where I've been working, and people come from the injection facility to detox because they've been brought into contact with compassionate caregivers, perhaps for the first time in their lives. These people all had very tough lives, and so for them to even contemplate receiving help takes a lot of trust.
Talk about the people you treat.
Well, the hardcore drug addicts that I treat, but according to all studies in the States as well, are without exception people who've had extraordinarily difficult lives, and the commonality is childhood abuse. In other words, these people all entered life under extremely adverse circumstances. Not only did they not get what they need for healthy development, they actually got negative circumstances of neglect. I don't have a single female patient in the downtown east side who wasn't sexually abused, for example, as were many of the men, or abused, neglected, and abandoned serially over and over and again. And that's what sets up the brain biology of addiction. In other words, the addiction is related both psychologically in terms of emotional pain relief and neurobiological development to early adversity.
What does the title of your book mean, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts?
Well, it's a Buddhist phrase. In the Buddhist psychology, there are a number of realms that human beings cycle through, all of us. One is the human realm, which is ordinary cells. The hell realm is that of unbearable rage, fear, pair, you know, these emotions that are difficult to handle. The animal realm is our instincts and our id and our passions. Now,
and that, again, is Dr. Gabor Mate, physician at the Vancouver Safe Injection Site, Insight. And he really is talking more about the roots of addiction and how it's a very interesting discussion, which I encourage you to check online at Democracy Now!, February 3rd, 2010, is where you can find it. Or if I get enough demand, I'll play some more of it on this show. I just don't like to replay what has already been played and what is publicly available. So, the real issue for us is, of course, to look at the rates of hepatitis C and AIDS in our community and to see why we can't do something similar here, either extra legally or, you know, eventually legally. It has to start somewhere and begin this process. I know Mike Rotkin will say they'll come from all over the world to our safe injection site, just like he says you can't have a homeless campground because they'll come from all over the world to sleep in the streets and so forth. You can't, you know, lift the sleeping ban. But it's time we started considering ourselves as Charles Gray, the homeless activist 20 years ago who worked with us, said, as Santa Cruz should consider itself a beacon rather than a magnet. And that perhaps is, in some respects, what we've been in other areas. At least that's what we think of ourselves as in terms of anti-war resolutions, although there haven't been any recently, and there hasn't been any investigation or discussion of war profiteering and investments in those kinds of firms or, I don't know, war resistance in any way. It's all, of course, very hush-hush because of the political connections and the failure to criticize the Obama administration. But I think we have to consider this drug issue as a local issue. It's time to start treating people who have drug addictions as a medical problem and not as a criminal one. It's just ridiculous, and we have to make it work here. Mayor Rotkin is not going to take these steps. City Manager Dick Wilson or his replacement, Martine Bernal, if Martine, now assistant manager, replaces him, they're not going to take these steps. Tony Madrigal is not going to take these steps. It's the citizenry that has to take these steps. And I remind people that the first medical marijuana clubs that opened up were completely illegal, and they operated quite openly. Maple Street Medical Marijuana Distribution Center, a club, was open for years, even before Proposition 215 passed in 1996. So, chew on that. Think about that. See if you want to work on that issue. I think we need to get active on it. And, you know, if we can't even defend the right to smoke marijuana or the right to use medical marijuana or to purchase medical marijuana, we're in real trouble with respect to these other issues, because unless you can start there, you kind of abandoned before you begin the whole question to right-wingers who are essentially trapped in a kind of delusional religiosity or an obsession with police solutions or a paranoid hysteria around drugs that has little to do with the real problem in any of what I believe to be the real solutions. You can give a call if you want, 427-3772. I'm on free radio. My name is Robert Norris, and you can be too, at least while my show is on the air. Let's go back to a few street interviews, or actually, how about a little bit of a musical break, and then we'll roll forward with some street interviews. Here's a street singer singing a song. Opal's Son, her name is.
Like a melody, it's haunting me. You're in my memory. You tell a story, telling me of the heart and what it imparts. You tell me, keep it in mind, don't leave it behind. I'll never forget you. You see me through. All I wanna do is be with you. Your face, it's every place. Just the touch of your hand takes me to wonderland. I'm never alone. Into my life you are so. Don't ever disappear. Stay right here. I need you to renew. watching me. You're in my memory. You tell a story, telling me of the heart and what it imparts. You tell me, keep it in mind, don't leave it behind. I'll never forget you. You see me through. All I wanna do is be with you. All I wanna do is be with you.
He is, of course, a criminal. And getting back to that restroom police action, there were originally two city workers and four police officers, including two sergeants. That's six city employees to deal with one guy who they held, grilled, and finally he walked away from the whole thing with no problem, which I'm glad to see, but one wonders why it took five men and one woman heavily armed to deal with that situation. I think that's a form of paranoia.
And we're talking about incident that happened some weeks ago, which I actually played on the air. Queuing up the tapes now to make sure I'm in the right place here. These are street interviews that I have, which I usually find very helpful if I can actually get them queued up properly, which is sometimes a problem. Let's see where we're at here. Yeah, okay. We're actually at a point where I can play some. This is from last week of January. I think it's January 23rd. Let's see where we're at with this particular street interview. Actually, these are both street interviews and bits of street life.
Okay, well, it is Saturday, 22nd or the 23rd, I'm not sure which, of January 2010, and I'm out here on Cathcart talking with
Street Guy.
And Street Guy, you just kind of rolled up on your bicycle at about 15 to 10 here to let me know, to remind me of actually an front page article in the yesterday's Sentinel about the Vets Hall being closed.
Yeah, I saw the signs and I heard it on the radio, and I went by this morning to check on the, quote, damage to the facade, end quote. And I discovered a spot on the backside of the building that's on the auditorium part in the rear. That's about 18 inches long, exposing some of the rebar. from underneath. It didn't look like a particularly dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like yet another scam to corral the homeless, especially the homeless veterans.
And who's responsible for this?
It's hard to say. If the signs that show the contact points for booking information are in any way accurate, Tim happens to be part of Tim, who runs the Vets Hall.
Tim Breton.
Yeah, appears to be part of the Parks and Recreation Department. That's what the that's who his boss is, because that's where you go to get information about bookings at this time. So when you consider the actions of people like John Wallace, it looks, the whole business looks pretty fishy, especially in light of the recent music programs that Larry Cousin, you know, and whoever the operator of the shortwave station was, they were trying to, I hear, start a new radio station locally.
Now, what about the actions of John Wallace? Tell me more about this. Chief Ranger in Santa Cruz.
Well, his willingness to confiscate and destroy personal property is pretty much a legend in this county.
Have you had any personal experience of this yourself?
Not in terms of property, but I've caught him outside the city trying to throw his weight around.
And give me more specifics. When did this last happen?
Well, this was several years ago. He hasn't done it in recent years because he knows he can be fingered. You're going outside of his jurisdiction.
Yeah, actually, I've heard. I mean, I'm asking because I'm interested in your experience, and I've actually heard of his. People have complained of his doing this actually more recently, and that's why I wanted to get more specifics. And, you know, I'd like to see the practice ended myself.
If you're talking about the property confiscation?
And destruction, yeah.
Okay, well, I don't know. Like I say, my biggest beef with him is that he used to go outside the city boundaries to throw his non-existent weight around under those circumstances.
It's actually illegal to do it inside the city boundaries. If you're going to confiscate property, you've got to hold it for 60 to 90 days, I believe, under state law.
And don't you have to be prepared to issue a receipt as well?
I would think so.
But
I'm not familiar with that. You know, I would recall the details a lot. There was a case in Fresno 3 years ago where the homeless won $2.3 million because Caltrans and the city of Fresno was doing the same thing.
Okay, but at any rate, but any time, I've heard of people on the street had their buck knives confiscated by the police for no cause, and my understanding is that they're supposed to issue a receipt under those circumstances, and if you get cited for having it or anything, that citation becomes the effective receipt. But, as far as I know, there has to be a way for you to get a listing of an official listing of all the property that was seized.
Except he destroys it. So why bother even to give you a receipt if he's going to destroy it? At least that's what he told me 2 years ago when we were examining Parks and Rec records for sleeping van tickets. We've been talking with.
I'd really rather not give my name.
We'll call you Anomalous.
Okay.
As I often do.
Anomalous. Okay.
Thank you, sir.
And I think it was 3 or 4 years ago when I was in Chief Ranger Wallace's office making copies of the tickets he'd written out for sleeping, covering up his blankets, camping, coconut, in order to judge the extent of the harassment and violation of civil liberties that happened. Extensive. And he was quite candid about the destruction of property, and he used to store it years ago, but not anymore. It was too much trouble. They just post the site and say, got to be gone in 3 days. Property, or we'll take the stuff and throw it away, which is, I think if anybody challenges it, as was done in Fresno, a violation of state law. And I'm always looking for folks interested in holding these officials to account. If you are interested in this project, you call the HUF line. HUF is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and it's 423-HUF, 423-8287. Regarding the closing of the Veterans Hall, I saw an interesting comment on the Sentinel website under the article which talked about how the vet's own engineer went and looked at the so-called difficulties, the ailing property, the deteriorating facade, found something quite different, that there was no emergency, no need to evacuate the building. I'm going to read something about that in a moment. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hey, Robert, it's Louie.
Hey, Louie, what's new? You're on the air.
Oh, well, I just wanted to give you a little heads up. You got some kind of mic problem going on there. You're cutting out and not too clear. And
Well, thank you, because I think you pointed out that one mic was up that should have been down, and one was down that should have been up. So
okay, that could be it.
Sometimes up is down, and down is up until we get people like yourself correcting it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to be of help.
Thank you.
Thanks. That's it.
All right. So this is a joint enterprise, indeed, even if we aren't smoking here in the studio. If you do hear me fading away into the distance, that means I've transferred mics and I haven't transferred proper volume controls. Rather than remedial mic work, which, of course, probably is useless in a man of my age and disabilities, I need some immediate support. Probably not needle injection at this time, but perhaps just a swift slap across the chops or a gentle reminder, as we just heard. Here's something from the vets, or an individual, I think Gordon Smith of Monterey, who is the comment, is sounds knowledgeable, but here's what he writes. I don't know how accurate it is, but you judge for yourself. Again, this is in the article in which the vets engineer came in to take a second look at what the city said required closing down the Veterans Hall for God knows how many months or years. And I actually talked with vet activist Bob Patton on this issue last show. Here's what Gordon Smith writes. Let's get the facts straight. One, this is not a one-room vets hall. This is a huge historical veterans memorial building. Two, the County of Santa Cruz doesn't own the building for public use. It holds the deed in trust for the perpetual use of all U.S. military veterans and their organizations as a remembrance, a memorial, of those who fought and died in the Great War, World War I. Three, the County of Santa Cruz has over the past 20 years acted in bad faith against the veterans and has reduced their occupation and the use of the building substantially. Four, County of Santa Cruz has kicked the Bill Motto post 5888 out of their room 23 and have leased it to a private entrepreneur who for profit teaches yoga classes. Five, previously room 23 and other rooms have been occupied by congressional chartered veterans organizations for six decades. Six, during the 7.1 Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989, other buildings surrounding the Vets Memorial Building collapsed, resulting in several deaths directly across the street. Yet, the steel-reinforced concrete Vets Memorial Building remains solid and undamaged. Seven, a brief preliminary inspection results in an immediate and complete evacuation of the whole building. How stupid do they think we are? Better asked, how stupid are they? And that's Gordon Smith in Monterey. I believe some of the discussion on this website was to the point that the county does not want to give the vets the power to control their own building, particularly manager Tim Bratton, who's been in a power struggle with the vets for years, has been trying to expand the for-profit use of the vets building over the objections of vets, and also has had numerous close encounters of the police kind with homeless vets trying to use the bathroom and so forth, resulting in some real concerns, although I've always felt they haven't really dealt with Bratton in the kind of straightforward way they need to, which is, frankly, tell him to either shape up or kick his ass out, so to speak, one way or another, or demand that his behavior significantly change. Instead, you know, there are many letters, angry letters to the Times and legal court maneuverings that don't seem to go anywhere, letters to the Attorney General and pious statements by this vet official and that vet official. Anyway, so that's, I just wanted to kind of throw that in because in the middle of the street interview, you heard a vet talking about his concern about the vets hall being closed, and that's still the case as far as I know. The vets hall is still closed. I guess the vet Bob Patton said they're waiting on a report coming in March, and who knows, maybe we'll get an update on that. I asked Bob if he wants to give a call in. Maybe he'll give a call either today or on Sunday when we come back for a longer show in the morning. Back to the streets.
Okay, well, we're talking with
Barton Jackson.
And Barton, you've just handed me two cards from the Sheriff Coroner's office, mm-hmm. One from Stephen Fish, Sergeant, another from, you say, a young officer.
That's right.
And on that second card it says, you need to have to move on, we'll be back. If you stay, arrest or cites will be made.
Correct. I also got the tickets that already issued. Uh-huh. I have the officer's name who issued the ticket.
Uh-huh.
And what they did is they got him for trespassing. He was back there picking up trash. Okay, we're all back there picking up trash. They
so how many tickets were issued?
Only one.
Yeah.
Okay, so yesterday was his court date.
And this is a guy, he was ticketed for, what was he ticketed for?
He was ticketed for trespassing.
And where was this?
This was over on the other side. This was actually in the Poganet, but it's actually the place that he's camping at. It's called the easement, which is 50 feet from the waterway.
Uh-huh.
So actually it's government property, not county. And not city. But we had city police come out there. They couldn't give us tickets because we're considered as on private property. So they went to the sheriff's. The sheriff's came out there, told us if we don't leave, they were going to give us trespassing tickets. Then the city came out and put in a new fence that we used to go through.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, put up a 6-foot fence with barbed wire and put up cameras.
And this is on a part of the Poganet that is usually open to the public or not?
Yeah, it is open to the public, but on that side, there's no access to it.
Now,
the access to it is through going across the river. But when the river's flooded, there's no access to it unless you trespass on other people's property.
Now, at the time you were, or he was given the citation, was it day or night?
It was in the day.
And so the Poganet was open.
The Poganet was open, yes.
So what happened next?
So what happened is they threatened the next people that are there after they arrest Randy, because they said that they were going to come out there and arrest Randy Roberti for trespassing and not complying with the law.
This is another person?
This is the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I got the tickets here that proves that Randy Roberti already had a ticket for trespassing, and he didn't appear in court yesterday, so they have a $5,000 bond warrant for him for failure to appear on a trespassing ticket.
This is a misdemeanor trespass or an infraction trespass?
It's a misdemeanor as far as I know.
Interesting. Okay, we're going to take a look at the ticket here. It's around 10. We're in front of Noah's Bagels moving down up and down the sidewalk up Pacific Avenue on a, well, cloudy Saturday morning. You're getting into your backpack. Find this ticket,
mm-hmm.
And I'm checking out the local Sentinel for its latest stories on what's going on in and around town. Cemex plant to shut down for good. There go the jobs.
Good.
And let's see what's happening here.
Washington River. There it is.
And you're pulling out a yellow ticket from your waterproof section of your wallet here.
Well, you don't have to worry about the camp anymore because it went down the river during the flood.
So there was, do you see we were flooded out in the last few days?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The citation 6020, trespassing refusal to leave. This means he was told to leave and he refused. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, he can't leave because he's got a broken back and a broken neck, and they know it. We showed x-rays. We told him that he had a broken back.
Come on over here.
Okay.
A little bit closer.
And yet, though, they still continue to come out there and harass the guy.
Uh-huh.
And since I'm going to be his care provider once he's on, you know, Medi-Cal.
Right.
Okay, so I'll be his in-home support service for, yeah, for the county.
And again, this is Stephen.
And they threatened me with their arrest after I told him.
And this is Stephen Fish, the sergeant, did?
Yeah.
And what did you tell Sergeant Fish?
Well, I told Sergeant me, mm-hmm. personally, yeah, I was going to be there for the arrest, but it ended up raining and we're flooded out, so we weren't there. We was hoping that we would have Channel 8 News and Channel 2 News out there, because we wanted the helicopters to be there. Fire department would have to come and get them.
Is it? Mm-hmm. So there's a warrant out for this for your friend with a broken back?
Yeah, sure is.
And so he is a disabled fugitive, eh?
Yeah, disabled fugitive.
And what is his name? Does he want to get? Does he want
bum rush him? They might bum rush him and you know, just be totally rude towards him instead of being compassionate. You know what I'm saying? Like they normally do with handicapped people, slam them on the ground, let's abuse him some more, kick him around. You know, it's all good.
Uh-huh.
You know, as long as nobody's seen nothing and turn their head the other way, it's all good.
So, Ed, but have you observed any of this kind of abuse yourself?
No, I've seen it many times. Right?
What's the last time you saw this?
Well, the last time I saw that was, let's see. I'll take you an example this morning. Down at the homeless shelter, someone was down there trying to get seconds on breakfast, and they had a whole bunch of eggs and stuff. And the guy says, you know, hey, you know, instead of throwing that away, can I have seconds? Well, next thing you know, she calls the police on him. Next thing you know, he's kicked off the property because he refused to go because he asked for seconds. He gets manhandled off the property and told that if he resists, he's going to go to jail for resisting arrest.
Now, what was the...
So he didn't want to do no resisting arrest, so he ended up leaving.
What was his name?
I don't know what the kid's name is, but these are the unfair injustice that people seems to close their eyes and turn their head the other way.
What about the other? Was there any? Did he have any support from other people? Did they say this is unfair?
Of course not, man. They all have to eat there and live there. You know what I'm saying?
So even you said nothing yourself when you saw it happen.
Me?
Yeah. I'm not saying you should because you have that same problem, but did you make any complaint or response to either the police or the management?
Then I'll be harassing the police, and then next thing you know, I'll be the one going to jail.
I hear you, man. So in other words, I'm not saying you should have, but you felt intimidated from doing that, right?
Of course.
Okay.
Because they'll take your ass to jail. They'll say that you're obstructing justice, and then they'll take you to jail anyway.
So I intend to put this out on the radio. Is that something you want?
Good.
Okay.
Do that.
Okay. And again, we've been talking with?
Barton Jackson.
Barton, thank you. I wish I had some, you know, helpful advice for you, except that if you can give me a contact point for you and we actually ever find a lawyer to start addressing these issues of abuse, which is a hard thing to do.
Yeah, because there's no attorney in Santa Cruz County that will file suit against the county because they all work here, live here.
Well, it's hard to find. It's sure hard to find. Yeah.
To file suit. Same thing when I filed suit against Seaside. I can find no attorney to file suit against.
You want to document, and you're helping us actually to document that this is actually happening. You're giving us the specifics. If you can't give me a contact, a name or number, I'll take it off tape where you can be found, and I will then, if we ever get anywhere with this, or have more, and also encourage other people to do the same, who are having the same problem.
The problem I have trying to get a hold of you is I keep on getting on the voicemail and I have to get looped back.
Right, I'm rarely at the room I live at, so I do have to check my voicemail. And there's a meeting every week of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, on Wednesday morning at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific, about a block from the Saturn. You can always direct people to come there. Let me give you some of my cards.
Yeah, okay.
I'm here with Brad on the
Hello,
corner.
Hello, how are you? Hi.
Heidi, who to have? Brad, are you, a certain Jeremy Nooner of Nextspace, which is an office right above, I don't know, the Authentic Apparel Pacific Wave on, what is this? This is Cooper Street, Cooper and Pacific. You said there's been an incident that's happened that you noticed?
Well, we were sitting over here, I was panhandling, and Tony the tow truck driver, and Floyd the ex, 60 sailor hippie, and one of the person were sitting here, and the next thing you know, some guy set up a kind of obsequiously smoking cigarettes, and apparently it was a guy on his break from NOAA's taking a cigarette break.
Right.
And the next thing we know, Jeremy was screaming, and we looked around, and he was in the guy's face. He was pointing at him. He was right in his face. He was right up there. I'm going to have you fired. You
Jeremy Nooner.
You can't smoke on this bitch. I'm going to have you fired and killed. I want you out of here. And the guy, of course, was being treated with disrespect, and so he just lit another cigarette.
Now, let me get straight. You were in front of O'Neill's on the two benches here.
Right in front of O'Neill. And the other guys were on the bench.
So you were standing here on the corner, and the other guy was on the bench next to O'Neill's.
And
across the street from O'Neill's is another bench. I'm describing it for the audience.
He's over on the right side.
Which is about...
Three feet illegally smoking length. He would have to be standing by the first bike rack behind the bench legally to smoke. So that 3 feet is what was in contention. That three extra feet.
So Jeremy wanted him to move 3 feet. And
well, he didn't say that, but it is. One of the other guys in there earlier told us, like a week ago, he was very gruff about a month ago, but he was very right. He goes, you can't smoke on that bench. It's only 22 feet. You can smoke 25 feet from that 22.
Right.
And I thank you very much, But he was nice about it. but that's not Jeremy's way. Jeremy's got mental problems, man. Worse than that, Jeremy's a psycho derelict. Jeremy's like Norman Bates castrated. He's really sick. He's not a sexual threat, but he's a Norman Bates threat no matter what.
And you say that the manager of Noah's, Nancy, also saw this.
Well, he went and called the cops, and then Joey had to sit there.
Jeremy called the cops?
Yeah, and then Joey was trying to get up, and Jeremy was holding him down, wouldn't let him. You're not getting away, you know.
He was physically restrained him.
He was physically dancing around him like that. No, pushing him back. After a while, Joey had to get back to work, you know. He was going to be late for work. Anyway, so the downtown lady, Gina, her friend, came up, and then eventually Cobb and then Nancy came, and I didn't hear anything they were saying. I was over here. But after all, I heard Nancy was going like that and doing this, and she goes, you know, I don't want you harassing my employees, you know, and I know we're not trying to cause an incident, but I'll be goddamn fine, like, blah, blah, you know. She was doing a pretty good job. So I went in the next day, and I said, Nancy, way to go. I mean, you handled that really well. And she goes, that's the second time he's done that to Joey. The second time, the first time he was charging in here saying, you better fire this guy, push my employees out of the way, a customer, knocked him over. He was like, so Jeremy's, you know, and they're not doing anything to him.
Somewhat extreme in his response.
Yeah, and then what Nancy told me was that, Joey, you know, the first time it was something like that a couple days earlier, and she goes, Joey, do you want, you know, they were going to call the cops, and Joey decided not to press charges. They're being really nice about it. But they said when he walked in their store, he stormed in there like a, you know, like a rhino, and he was knocking stuff over, grabbing people, wanted to see the boss. I insist you fire this guy. My people are never going to work at, come and do business with Noah's again. It was really embarrassing. I mean, it was like watching a guy have a nervous breakdown.
And for those who don't know, sorry about that mic problem, that is, Brad is speaking of Jeremy Nooner, who's either the office manager or the CEO of Next Space, the Ryan Coonerty founded organization that is at the on the second floor of the Cooper and Pacific building, I guess above Pacific Way or thereabouts. And there have been concerns about Jeremy's being particularly hostile to the homeless and coming out and calling the police on them for sitting on the bench outside the entrance to New Space on Next Space on Cooper Street. This is an incident where he's apparently upset with, again, if Brad's account is accurate, with somebody who is smoking. And you know, again, it's always seemed to me, I mean, I'm not a big fan of smokers, I always say, but if you want someone not to smoke, you got to, you know, say, you know, I wonder if you could move a little bit further away or downwind. I'm kind of sensitive. I got a throat problem, or could you? Instead, of course, what's being done is no smoking signs are being put up, and police are given the power to go after smokers, and then they can selectively choose who they want to harass. I frankly don't see a lot less smoking on Pacific Avenue. In fact, people are kind of regarding it as a badge of defiance. I saw it a lot today as I walked up and down Pacific. I've actually spoken to Jeremy Nooner, who's quite civil to me. He wasn't mean or nasty. He actually is the one who approached me. We happened to be in the same business together. It was a locksmith. We were both getting keys made or something, and he recognized me, and I didn't know who he was, but he introduced himself, and, you know, he kind of wondered why I was, quote, supporting a known drug dealer. He was referring to a guy called Brian Parquette, who he called a drug dealer, who he had no specific evidence that Brian was any kind of a salesperson of either hard or soft drugs, although, you know, I frankly, as you can probably heard from my earlier feelings on the show, I'm not particularly upset with people who sell, use, or possess drugs. Although I'm not a fan of hard drug use, and I think, you know, that obviously you want to protect minors, and, you know, you don't want, there are all kinds of problems connected with drug abuse, but the idea that, you know, you can suddenly use the code words drug dealer, drug use, and everybody and a mob of people with torches is ridiculous. I'd rather hear them say the word bankers and run after the bankers, you know. It makes a lot more sense to me. Or politicians, you know, go down and burn down City Hall. That makes a lot more sense, although I'm not a fan of arson. I'm saying, though, that kind of hostile attitude is misdirected. And I think it's an intentional kind of misdirection. It's a created scapegoat. It has very little to do with real social problems. I mean, it's a straw man. Anyway, back to the street interview. Jeremy Nooner, I thought, had kind of, after having been held to account a bit online and also over the air, he kind of pulled in his pulled in his fangs somewhat, if to use that phrase, and not gone after homeless people as much as he was in the past. But apparently this isn't just about the homeless. This may be a, you know, a anger management problem that Jeremy has. The problem then would be I'm not interested in you know, dredging up Jeremy's problems online specifically, but rather I'm concerned about when the police and merchants and politicians kind of collude in helping and empowering people with, you know, who believe that they want to use the police force to exert their power to, I don't know, get rid of the smoker or get rid of people, a musician outside their, you know, down the block. And they can do this because the police are giving them wide latitude as part of a sort of a cleanup campaign. That, to me, is something that's upsetting and a matter of some public concern.
Look, it was pretty amazing.
That sounds like at least the second, if not the 19th, nervous break.
I would say he's towards 5-6. He's crawling up the records ladder. Pretty soon he'll be up there for an Emmy, you know. An Emmy nitrate or whatever, an injection. He needs one.
We've been talking with?
Dory. I mean, Brad.
Thank you, Brad.
You're welcome.
Well, I'm talking with Curb Hugger Chris here on the sunny but still wet Saturday morning, about 10:20. We're heading toward parking lot number 4. I guess it's more than parking lot number 4. This is the adjacent parking lot where the farmer's market and the drum circle are usually held. Chris,
you have a friend who lives in this parking lot. I mean, I don't want to give names. I don't want to describe.
He
does quite well at hiding completely within the parking lot, has since August, and somehow manages to get away with it. But I must admit that he puts a great deal of stealth into his effort.
Well,
so,
we saw this morning, or at least I did, and I guess then you subsequently did some non-stealthy First Amendment activity. You would think it's First Amendment protected. There were three clinic escorts who were apparently trying to, oh, I don't know, protect the safety and security of people using the clinic, the Planned Parenthood clinic on Pacific Avenue. And then there were several, I presume, some anti-choice people. Yeah, we're approaching them now. I'm going to give you the tape recorder.
You can keep
comments.
All right.
So make sure you make comments.
Comments. Oh, regarding, okay, well, we're walking up to the back of the Logos bookstore, and I see one fellow carrying an umbrella, dubious that he's going to need the umbrella, but he's wearing a smock that says Planned Parenthood Marmonte, and then a fellow in a yellow shirt, clinic escort, and over across the way, it looks like some other folks standing around. It looks like they might be involved with them, and they're, oh, no. Okay, wait a minute. Those are the right-wingers. Those are the right-wingers right there, too. So they got them out on the sidewalk, too, as well. With their rosary beads. Very, very imposing. If you want to talk, I'm here.
A couple of you looking at here are critics.
Cedar sign is illegal, though, I think, up against the...
We have a gentleman who are supportive, the clinic escort, will allow people to...
Probably a little obscure to listeners what's going on here. This was, I believe, Saturday the 30th, maybe, thereabouts, January, maybe the week before, I'm not sure. There were two groups of people in the parking lot, parking lot number 4 in the adjacent parking lot, right behind Logos Bookstore, where it's right next to the back entrance of Planned Parenthood, where there was, I guess, an abortion counseling clinic, or possibly, I'm not sure if that's what surgical procedures were happening there, I don't know. But there were a number of people, some of whom I recognized. Karen Gillette was there, former homeless community research center operator, a manager, and executive director, and now working to secure the safety and well-being of clients, Planned Parenthood. And then there were those who were, I think, like Operation Rescue type folks concerned with publicizing alternatives to abortion, attacking the right choice and the right to choose an abortion, probably trying to discourage people who were going in to seek counseling and possibly consider an abortion. It was hard to get a clear statement about it. I wasn't, you know, that interested in their positions. Supporter of choice myself. What I noticed was, and you'll hear me talking about this on the tape, both these groups were situated.
situated in the middle of an illegal space, a space that Vice Mayor Coonerty made illegal, and the council voted to make illegal, for and is enforced against homeless people and other folks who are simply socializing. You're not allowed to be in a parking lot on anywhere in the downtown area that is on public property unless you either are parking or retrieving a vehicle. And then you have only 15 minutes to do that. You can't hold up signs. You can't monitor for Planned Parenthood. And yet these people were doing this openly, although admittedly there were no police cars in the area observing them. We thought, I wouldn't say we thought long and hard, but we certainly did give some thought to calling the police on both these groups and having them both arrested for being in the parking lot. Not because we think they should be arrested for engaging First Amendment activity, far from it, but because the police selectively used Coonerty's law. First, they packed a drum circle with it extensively until drum circle people stood up. This is the group that gathers every Wednesday at the farmer's market and insisted, you know, you can ticket us all to death if you want. And Sergeant Harms then changed his campaign and backed off. But more recently, people like Officer Winston have been pursuing people into this area where they go to smoke occasionally. This one guy did, because he wants to obey the no smoking within 25 feet of a window or open doorway on a side street. Even again, no smoking on Pacific Avenue at all, and no smoking within 25 feet on the side streets, trying to get into a parking lot where he could do it, and Winston ticketed him for being in the parking lot. And this is a selectively enforced law that denies everybody basic rights, but that is winked at by the police in terms of middle-class activists. So we had a video camera with us. We had an audio, but it was really kind of impromptu. We didn't get the kind of evidence we really needed, I think. But the point is, it has to be made that this is the kind of two-tiered system where those who have money and political power can ignore the laws that are passed to criminalize poor people. That's really what this is about.
Keep commenting. I'm running out of things to comment on. What should we do? Let's go see. There's more on the sidewalk, you know. They've got, like, big signs out on the sidewalk, but I missed those.
We have two individuals who are, again, part of the clinic escort. Notice that they are in the parking lot, which is an illegal activity.
If they're here for more than 15 minutes, right?
No, if they're not parking or retrieving a vehicle. They can be here for 15 or 20 minutes if they're parking.
If they're parking or retrieving a vehicle.
If not.
All right.
So you're all a bunch of... So let me interview you for this situation.
Actually, you know what?
What?
Actually, I don't think you'll help our cause.
Well, I'm trying.
We're worried about our cause.
Our cause is the right of homeless people
and we get jacked up all the time for being in this parking lot.
It doesn't have to do with homeless people.
Oh, it does.
Right, but it does to us. You see, because you won't be fucked with, and we do all the time. We get screwed with.
So you don't understand.
They get screwed with all the time. You're trying to just walk through this parking lot.
Hold on. He doesn't
understand.
I don't care. Okay, so I don't care whether he understands or not. Okay, I don't give a shit about his movie.
Yeah.
I really don't.
Let me tell you, the first thing is, you should never use language like that when you're trying to promote a cause. You
I'm, not
have
to, I'm not trying to promote crap. I'm a journalist, man.
Yeah. Well, you're putting.
I'm journalizing the fact that you're breaking the law. You got any comments on that?
No, you're not helping the situation. You're
all
not
right.
helping your situation.
I don't
you're
care about your situation. I'm doing gangbusters for my situation.
I think you're wasting your time.
Yeah? We'll see. It'll be on the radio this week. And on the web. So we get lots of hits. How many hits does your website get?
Here's a couple of folks who are, critics of the abortion situation.
Now. We didn't give you guys permission to film us.
It doesn't matter. You're in public. I can film anything I want.
Yeah.
Check the Constitution of the United States of America.
I believe in the homeless cause.
Okay.
I help out at St. Francis Soup Kitchen twice a week.
Place I never go because they banned the deadheads back in the 80s. They've never invited me back. How do you feel about that? Hey, apparently she has no comment. Well, this has been a lot of fun, Robert. I really have to thank you. This is Kurt Bunker Curse, by the way.
Yeah.
Neither
side seems to understand the significance of this.
Well, no, but did we say didn't give a shit? You know what I mean?
Well, they don't understand
that. And I mean, I'm not even taking sides here. I'm a journalist, man. I'm just trying to see what they're doing with the parking lot.
Of course, you are on one side because you...
You know, I notice they're being kind of careful to keep close to the building. I wonder what...
Not these two.
But not these two.
Who are in the middle of the parking lot.
Right. So they can't stew around in here according to municipal law, you're saying.
Right.
And more than... Even if their car is in here, which it might be.
That's correct.
So they may be allowed, 15 minutes tops because their car's in here, but that's it, right? Is what you're saying.
Parking or retrieving it. You know, that's what the wording of a...
But they're not.
So and we should probably advise these people that they are, in fact, violating the ordinances of the city. Here's another...
Why should we advise them?
Because I think the ordinances should be changed.
Okay, can we go... Let's go see the ones on the sidewalk. They're much more exciting. They got big signs of fetuses.
Yeah, I'm not really interested in a particular protest going on.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the right of homeless people to move the parking lot. And apparently people who are privileged, like the escorts and the critics, the anti-abortion people, think that they can do whatever they want with their protest. But
well, I see a couple of homeless guys over here. Would you like to go interview them? They'd probably be interview friendly. So, all right. We're going to this curb hugger, Chris, and just to try to keep this all rolling along here, we're going to see if we can... These are known homeless people in this parking lot. Oh, I thought it was just strange homeless people, but these are known homeless people, and they are being converged upon here. You look so beautiful today. Hi, Mark. Well, all we want to know is what you feel about the fact that you would get run out of this parking lot in about 10 more minutes if you stand here very long. But these folks here seem to be have a ticket to ride. How do you feel about that? I mean, these escort clinics can hang out here all day.
I've never been escorted out, personally.
Do you know people who have been asked to leave this parking lot for being lingering too long here beyond the municipal code?
Hiding behind a tree.
Well, I didn't exactly want to get on camera.
You actually didn't get on camera.
I've seen people asked to leave, but in the 2 years I've been here, I haven't seen any major incidents.
I've heard of people being cited in the last month here. One fellow said he was told by Officer Winston he couldn't smoke on Pacific Avenue. He walked over here to smoke. Winston followed him and gave him a ticket for being in a parking lot. So.
Oh, yeah.
You stop signing. I just woke up. So
okay. We don't allow people to jump. So it's now about 10:40. Still in front of Planned Parenthood and still in the parking lot area, between parking lot number 4 and the adjacent area. And we have two folks who are still here, one with Planned Parenthood and one a clinic escort. Do you folks have a permit to be here? I'm asking them, and they're retreating to the sidewalk, moving off the parking lot, and therefore apparently no longer illegal. Karen Gillette is taking off her clinic escort shirt. And actually, I'm supportive of what they're doing, but not supportive of the law that apparently they don't wish to follow either. So you'll notice that they don't have anything to say, so we assume that they don't have a permit.
They're packing up this right.
Yeah, so that's good. We know what's going on here.
I think we threw a wet blanket on both sides.
It could be.
We're talking at the shelter.
And what's happening at the shelter now?
And before we get into that, just to conclude, I want to apologize for the low mic. I'm going to try to pay a lot more attention to it. I've gotten a second call advising me that it's hard to hear. I think it is, again, human error rather than equipment error, so we can't blame Uncle Dennis or the previous programmers. So thank you, folks, for calling in. Do call in if you suddenly get very quiet, you know. Then definitely call in because it probably means I'm ignoring proper mics, or maybe there's a problem with the equipment. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. This is Robert Norse on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Call-in number here is 427-3772. We're listening to interviews from the end of January, and sounds like that's definitely a call-in, and so let's take it. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, it's Bob.
Hey, Bob.
Battle-weary Bob calling in.
Well, that's good news. You probably heard me read Gordon Smith's comments, perhaps?
No, I didn't. I've been busy around the issue, however.
The issue of the Vets Hall.
The Vets Hall. Hall.
Or the former Vets Hall, now the empty building, the walled off, you can't go in, locked up building, right?
That's exactly right. We're just doing everything we can to get that order rescinded, and I mean reopened as soon as possible. So I'm encouraging the public, your listeners, and through various medias, and as you read the Gordon Smith, former commander, his letter. There's also a on Bratton Online, another former commander, Harry Meserve.
It's not Tim Bratton, I would hope.
No, it's different spelling, Bratton, but he's a well-known columnist. He's still got a radio program on campus air.
Oh, Bruce Bratton, you mean.
Bruce Bratton, yeah.
He formerly wrote for the Metro, yeah.
Right. So he's online. This week's gossip includes some of the suspect between the line reasons behind it. We have found that the necessity is not there. However, the reason is he said, she said thing, at least until developments can make it clearer and expose it for the public to make their decision. However, the timeline looks like is we've gotten the engineer, who's not just an engineer, but a seismic engineer. He's going to release the full report now. It's coming to the veterans first, I believe. However, he has his free hand to direct mail to county if he thinks that's the most necessary thing.
What does he think is the most necessary thing?
He can mail directly to the county.
The report.
The report.
Is that online yet or available or?
No, we're waiting for it in hard copy right now.
Mm-hmm.
With a letter.
This report fundamentally says that there's no real seismic problem. That's more of a sort of a superficial problem.
Basically it says county's pulling your leg, but we don't know the reason. We know the necessity's not there. We're still developing more research around the reason, and that reason seems to be. One bottom line is this deferred maintenance. The responsibility lay with the county to do maintenance of any memorial that they take into ownership. And the ownership was declared in what's called a letter of agreement.
Right. Well, they don't want to do the maintenance. Is that what you're saying? And therefore, they want to close down the building instead?
Hey, that's pretty good. I like the way you can synopsis things. That's basically it.
Well, Gordon Smith said, yeah, thank you, Bob. Gordon Smith said that the building survived quite well during the earthquake of 1989 while the buildings around it crumbled. But does it really need a lot of maintenance right now in the view of the seismic engineer and in your view?
In the view of the seismic engineer, the only damage there is isolated, and that needs to be repaired because it is... There's a fall zone hazard there of a few feet. However, it's nothing that can't be done with some basic construction, cordoning off a place, putting scaffolding up. So we're encouraged that be done. Maintenance be caught up.
Does he have an estimate on how much that would cost?
No.
Because that would be of interest. I mean,
he didn't go into that. However, the cost thing looks like the county... trying to holler this sky is falling because of the earthquake doesn't pan out because in his opinion, this is not the kind of building, not the kind of construction, not the area that the feds would even think of investigating or inspecting on behalf of a site.
It's not a real problem, but again, that leads to a further question. If it's not a real problem, and if we're only talking about minor repairs,
why does the county want to close it down? I mean, what's the reason? Why would they want to? Is it because of other expenses of the building? Is it because Tim Bratton, the manager, is, you know, has got a hard on to move people out of there? Or, I mean, I don't know that any. I mean, I can only speculate. But what do you think would be the reason if it's not a major repair required? Why is the county going to such effort to shut it down?
It answers the problem, or solves the problem of a few people, including the manager and basically the board of trustees.
Manager Tim Bratton and the board of trustees that he's largely, some say, stacked the board of trustees.
Definitely the process through getting volunteers onto the board of trustees is fairly much handled by those who are partisan to Tim Bratton's plans and techniques.
Well, Bratton, of course, is his big deal is to establish a lot of for-profit enterprises and the vets. So I suppose it's economically feasible or sensible in a certain appealing in a certain way. Although, as has been pointed out by Gordon Smith and by you and by others, the vets building is established and it's supposed to be held in trust for the vets by the county and, you know, and administered in that way. But you say, so what, again, what benefit does it serve either Tim Bratton or the Board of Trustees to have this building closed down?
Neither of those. I'm not exactly sure. Tim Bratton may still be in a position to keep his job, at least on a temporary basis, and that's not necessarily what we're looking for or what I think would be right. Let's say I can't speak for too many people.
I mean, I've heard a lot of complaints about Bratton, and I tend to feel they're justified, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I should believe that he's the mastermind behind closing it down or even that it's in his interest to close it down. So that's why I'm asking you, why would it be in his or the Board of Trustees' interest to close this building down?
I think more in general, it's the county itself.
How so?
They would get rid of a problem, the problem with the veterans having difficulty and going through arbitration, having hostile communications with both the board.
So the issue with the vets is the use of the bunker, which the county for some reason is having problems with, or the use of room 23. What are the issues, very briefly, Bob, what are the issues that you think the county is trying to get rid of if in fact they are trying to close down the building with this claim of a seismic problem that doesn't really exist to the extent that they claim it exists?
Wow, that's a long question.
Let me go back
for a short answer, but let me just say
you understand
this.
My question.
I get it. I got the sense of it. The building has been over time either a cash cow or a white elephant. So it goes back and forth: cash cow, white elephant. It seems like at this time, Tim Bratton was beginning to bring it into the cash cow part, but the veterans were having a lot of problems with the respect they needed around veterans' preferences, because this building, when in its agreement that the county took over it as a memorial, the United Veterans Council was directed to be those who organized the activities for the veterans organizations of the county. So that's been violated by the way that the management of the building through both particularly their manager, but the hope it's not, you know, malfeasant, but at least irresponsible or even maybe partisan actions on the Board of Trustees itself on behalf of Tim Bratton to make money on behalf of looking good to the county. So that kind of...
Does it serve their interest to close it down?
Yeah, the county's totally broke, and with all that friction going on with arbitration / litigation going on for the United Veterans Council, which had been directed to be a advocacy for all the veterans organizations in Santa Cruz County, now they're in direct litigation with that organization, and that...
Well, Is the county being
think they're throwing some cold water on that effort?
The county being sued by the veterans, or is there a sense of who's the opposing parties are? In other words, is the county stand to lose any money if the arbitration reaches a certain point, or the lawsuit, or it becomes a lawsuit? I mean, in other words, I'm trying to look for the meat here. What is it that the county might be afraid of that would make them close this down if that is in fact? We don't even know. You don't have any evidence that this is happening in terms of hard documents or even rumors from people who are in the inside, or do you?
That what is happening?
That the county is making a special effort to shut this building down because it is an expense in some way, or because they're afraid that it's going to cost them.
Well, you're exactly right. I have no hard evidence on that.
Right, well.
But you look at the county's budget coming up, and you may see some things that would allow those questions to be maybe not answered, but considered a little more closely. And right now, the county basically has no money. They're broke. Even with some upcoming minor repairs, well, not so minor, one, the boiler for the heating system there was going to need to be replaced. But they, I think, have positioned themselves to make the cuts for the maintenance of the Veterans Memorial Building be something more for their own security when it comes to financial. And I don't think they cared anything about either the vets or the yoga people.
Well, Bob, let me, because we're reaching the end of the show, may ask you is there anything more you would like people to do? I know you suggested calling the County Board of Supes. You've suggested which it has to be done during the day, or emailing them, which could be done at any time, or I guess giving the vets a call. And I was offering the Huff line, 423 Huff, for people to call in, and I've gotten no calls yet, but none.
Well, you can give the Veterans of Foreign Wars is one of the three major what it's called resident organizations in the building, and right now we're the ones who had brought the second opinion or alternate inspector there that has the conflicting report. And so that's our number. We now have it set up on a remote where we can check our, even though we can't get to our office, the electricity's still on, so AT&T is still on. And so I'll give that number out.
Go ahead.
And that's VFW 4298. 345, and that is a message. I'll do that again. 4298345. But there's at least three people checking that during the day, looking for various questions or requests or whatever people are looking for. Some are working around the arbitration/litigation. Others are working around the building closure. So you got two distinct efforts going on there.
Well, sounds good, Bob. We've got a 429-8345 if you want to be helpful to support the vets' attempt to return to their own building.
And that's exactly what we're asking for. We want to see a rescinding that closure. Oh, by the way, every Tuesday at 9 o'clock, the board meets. Supervisors meet in the county building.
At 9 o'clock in the morning.
Anyone can go in there and speak, like you can get your 2 or 3 minutes up there on anything that's not on the agenda.
Yeah, I know. I know we've been doing that for years.
Well, we're going to do that at some point. We encourage other people to go up there that have time or the interest to do that kind of work and get the point across about the Veterans Building. And the timeline is the next United Veterans Council meeting is going to be on the 23rd. So that's 3 weeks before they're going to hear it again on March the 16th at 9 o'clock. So all documents, including the ones from their engineers, the further report, quote unquote, should be available before then. So that's the timeline on it.
All right. Well, that sounds good. Our timeline is running out here.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate you giving me some time there and the questions and the
Well, I don't, you know, I'm cynical about the value of, you know, begging, pleading, and babbling at the Board of Supervisors, although there's nothing wrong with it. He also goes out to the community on community TV. I would hope that you would also be planning some direct actions of one sort or another, or protest actions, but then again, that's my endless mantra. So
we got all kind of lists, and there's one that's something like that.
All right, well, that's good. We'll be hoping to see your encampment and your military training outside the vets building, where you're actually taking over the police functions of the Santa Cruz Police Department and helping to free the homeless population from the sleeping van oppression.
Okay, so look for our comm unit out there. It'll be a big green truck with a big antenna.
That'd be good. Some tents, feed some people. We can have some. Maybe we can have some dances.
Hey, there we go.
Some romancing, you know.
Sure. Oh, we'll fly the flags high and dance.
Hey, baby. Thank you for calling
in,
Bob.
Thanks, Robert.
Bye-bye. That's about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I don't know if Uncle Dennis is going to be coming in. I see looks like a ringer has come into the studio, the infamous R. Duck. We've got a duck for the duck. He's here. And he's going to be, I think, taking over Dennis's show, unless maybe Dennis has finally fled to Haiti to play old 60s tunes to cheer up the Haitian refugees. Could that be? We don't know. Our man is keeping a respectful silence on the issue. Anyway, that's it for my show. I want you to consider tuning in again on Sunday when I have a longer show, if you like this kind of thing. 9:30 in the morning, go to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And if you want to catch me between times, I write on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz Indie Media, and I'm also reachable by phone, kind of. I'll call you back, or I'll try to, if you can arrange a contact point, I will try to find you. If you call it 423-HUFF, 423-4833, that's about it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadside. Let's go out on a few, a little more dialogue until our duck sets up his show, or I should say Uncle Dennis's From the Cream to the Dregs.
We're talking at the shelter.
And what's happening at the shelter now?
They just changed the rules that they're only accepting like 10 people to do community service to have free breakfast, and the rest of them have to pay 50 cents for their breakfast.
And how many is that who have to pay 50 cents?
It's a drop of 7.
And
it used to be 17. They've reduced it to 10 chores.
And what's the reason for that? I mean, surely saving, 7 times 50 is $3.50, or getting $3.50 off of people every day is not that big a deal.
No.
Who's in charge there, and who's making these decisions?
I have no idea. It changed from yesterday to today.
And what's your name?
My name is Eve.
And you are anonymous. Anything else about the homeless service center that you think we should know about?
No, I think they're doing the best they can, truly, the people that they're dealing with.
They are doing a decent job, actually. It's come a long way. So on the other hand, I mean, that's not too big of a knock, 50 cents for a good meal, actually.
And what does the breakfast consist of?
It's a decent breakfast, eggs, fruit, hot, cold cereal, milk, coffee.
Crepe Suzette, Benedict.
Eggs with meat in it, different chopped up ham, sausages, cheese. And they also have cakes.
It's served on the weekends?
Served every day.
All right. Well, I'll have to go out there sometime and pig out.
Yeah. Investigate it. You'll like it.
But they don't have
seconds.
It won't
disappoint you.
Now, I understand somebody was tossed out today for trying to get seconds.
That's right.
What happened there? Was that someone we know?
Ask her.
Tell me about this, Eve. Come on. No. Actually, I heard an earlier report. Was there any violence involved?
No, they just called the police.
Because a man or a woman wanted seconds.
I have no idea. I just heard it secondhand. That's what I heard, is they asked for seconds, and they said no, and then he proceeded to...
Please, sir, can I have some more?
Yes, exactly.
Get out of here. We're calling the cops.
I'm just going to throw all the eggs and stuff out.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's what
she said.
So. She gathered.
This is the secondhand report. Neither of you saw the situation.
All information that we gathered.
All right. Well, I'm glad that they're supporting our local garbage can. That's very appropriate.
Yeah.
Things certainly are improving at the homeless service center.
Right?
Anyway, thank you both, Eve.
Thank you. Have
care.
A great day.
All right.
And there you have it, Robert Norse. Wrapping up Bathrobe's Piers Broadside in elegant fashion, imitable, all that you come to expect here on FRSC. Thank you for tuning in. I'm the host of the R. Duck Show, here to try my hand at cream to the dregs, perhaps a little more like tea to the tea leaves, to the fortune. Do what we can to keep you going with the 60s and the 70s, so stay tuned, FRSC. The finest radio in Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. John McLaughlin doing his crazy little thing with Miles Davis. Back in those days when the days were just, gosh, a little longer, maybe a little cooler in some places, a little warmer in others. The ice knew what to do, and it did it well. Before that, the United States of America with their psychedelic little tune,